The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Hello, and welcome back to another reading of Our State, this time for November 2023. We're going to start out with an article about Sanford and then move to the Outer Banks. Brick City. Look around Sanford. It's practically all red. The Piedmont City is so famous for its clay and brick that it was once nicknamed the Brick Capital of the USA. Locals aim to preserve that distinction. Written by Billy Warden, there's a double-page spread here opening the article, and practically all I see is red brick in two buildings here. One of them says Coca-Cola, established 1905, on it, and the other looks like a town hall. The caption says, until the 1970s, Sanford's Art Deco-style Coca-Cola plant still bottled soda. Now renovated into a co-working space, it sits an alleyway away from the former town hall, built in 1909. And let's get going here. Don Perry doesn't merely tolerate the searing heat of his factory. The compact man of 65 marches right through the dust and din to its source. This kiln gets up to 2,000 degrees, he marvels, gingerly flipping open a peephole drilled into the side of a massive furnace to reveal a raging inferno. Inside, flames encase and harden bricks, tons and tons of them, day after blazing day. As the third generation proprietor of Lee Brick and Tile in Sanford, Perry regularly walks this factory floor, scrambling atop narrow scaffolding and conversing through the clanking commotion. As old hat as this tumult may be to the wry, gray-topped executive, he seems to revel in it. Outside, roaring machines the size of dinosaurs roll in from mines just over the pine-lined horizon, feeding the freshly clawed clay into vast sorting systems. That's what Lee County has an abundance of, red shale and clay, Perry declares. That's why at one point we were the brick capital of the USA. Indeed, a sign emblazoned with those very words once welcomed visitors to Sanford, which is located on U.S. Highway 1, about halfway between the gleaming high-rises of Raleigh and the elegant golf links of Pinehurst. Over the years, an untold number of businesses have here embraced the superlative, from the old Brick City Motors to Brick City Boba, the tea beverage made with tapioca pearls. Laborers willing to brave the soil and toil have long mined the great basins of red clay that squat under much of central North Carolina. But the industry has slowed, a function of changing consumer preferences and corporate doings. Today, Lee Brick is the last of what were once four family-owned brick-making businesses, booming in Sanford. Perry sags a little when he talks about the changes. "You can't freeze time, I guess," he says with a sigh. "Life goes on." While brick has long symbolized stability, even permanence, there's really no such thing. Sands shift, suns fade, empires crumble. Still, bricks brought prosperity and opportunities to Sanford. And as the town's 150th anniversary approaches in 2024, that sturdy legacy isn't going anywhere. As a showcase for all things brick, downtown Sanford is stacked. You can't throw a rock here without hitting a brick. At the center stands the train depot, built in 1910, apropos since the town's position as a railway crossroads helped brickmakers export their wares. Surrounding the depot are blocks of storefronts, offices, and erstwhile factories constructed with bricks of multiple hues and textures. From the stately Temple Theater to the whimsical Coca-Cola bottling plant, Sanford is a museum of masonry. While the various historic plaques around town note dates from the early 20th century, the origin of the brick in these buildings goes back a tad further, 240 million years, give or take. That's when the continents that we know today broke from one giant landmass and went their separate ways. Runoff from the newly formed mountains began sloshing into vast topographic basins. Eons worth of fallen plants, animal remains, and minerals all stewed in massive natural compost bins. It's from those so-called Triassic basins that Perry and so many others have pulled the stuff from which bricks, and in some cases dreams, are made. But the work was far from dreamy. It was hard, outdoors, quite a bit of sunshine, sometimes rain, remembers 100-year-old retired engineer Bob Brickhouse, yes, that's his real name, chatting on his way to church. Sure, my body ached, but we did a pretty good job, and what I liked most was the paycheck at the end of the week. Even in this era of increasing automation, Perry says, I've had people quit after 2 days. A long-running joke around town has it that a muscle-taxing week of mining, shaping, and cooking bricks has inspired many a Sanford lad to light out for college. But for those who stayed connected to the clay, other kinds of adventures awaited. On the opposite side of downtown from Lee Brick, another Sanford mainstay, Margaret Murchison, works in a far different environment from Perry's. Instead of roaring machinery, there's just the honeyed tones of radio voices inside the tiny but mighty WWGP AM and WFJA FM building. Since 1978, the ever ebullient Murchison, age 75, has reported the local news here, from hurricanes to who's got an extra sack of pecans to trade for tomatoes. Yet as far removed as Murchison is from Perry's factory, she, too, knows and reveres the industry born of red clay, especially the opportunities that it afforded. Her education in bricks started at the W.B. Wicker School. When it opened in 1927, the school provided vocational training to the region's black students and a fast track to success. Everyone knew that the boys training to be brick masons were the ones almost guaranteed to do well, she recalls, peering through wide spectacles, like a musicologist relaying a legendary canon of old gospel acts. Murchison rattles off a list of notable black masons, the Watson brothers, the Browns, an industrious church deacon who laid brick between hallelujahs. The clay pulled from the deep underground was their ticket up. They were in demand here and other places, Murchison said. They'd ride together to Fort Bragg or to Cary. They might be gone a whole week. They'd come back and tell stories about the beautiful houses in the suburbs. A lot of the Masons themselves lived in stick houses. They never got around to building their own brick house. But some did, and many of those are still standing. If enduring edifices are a tribute to the people who built them, then there may be no more heralded figure in Sanford than Arnold Lincoln Boykin. Known as A.L. or Link, the construction contractor took a lead role in all kinds of projects during much of the first half of the 20th century, from the old Stanford Post Office, now a pizza joint, to the W.B. Wicker School, now integrated and specializing in science, technology, engineering, art, and math. Today, from a mural on downtown's south side, Boykin's serious eyes gaze out at the community to which he contributed. Similar paintings appear all over, honoring local baseball sluggers, war heroes, and even the cows that provide ingredients for the ice cream at Yarborough's, located in the former Fairview Dairy. The murals are both a colorful celebration of Sanford's storied past and evidence of efforts to make the former brick capital's present just as vivid. Any number of seasoned Sanford residents can provide a take on the history of the brick capital, and many eagerly offer to do so. But when it comes to making sure that the city's brick legacy remains vibrant today and tomorrow, few know the ins and outs better than Kelly Laudate. Like Perry and Murchison, the executive director of the Downtown Sanford, Inc., grew up here, and she bubbles with love for the place. Darting through historic downtown in a black Tesla, she points out all of the ways that creative owners are reinventing the old brick buildings. A hot spot for gourmet lunches here, an Airbnb there. Everything here has so much history, she says, and so much potential. Under the cover of vines, behind the depot, smack in the middle of downtown, slouches a decrepit brick railroad warehouse. It's forgotten to most, but not to Laudate. It has a mezzanine, she says. It could be a great place to see music. A place, she suggests, along the lines of Saxipaw's esteemed Haw River Ballroom. The red clay, harking back to prehistoric convulsions and mind long ago, lives on, taking on new meaning. Laudate herself is working with her husband Jamie on reviving the long-shuttered progressive grocery store as a restaurant. There's just one hurdle. In these busy times for Sanford, she's having trouble booking a brick mason. That was written by Billy Borden, and our next article, Shifting Sands, was written by Ryan Stansel. On the eastern edge of the state, our barrier islands are shaped and reshaped by the whims of wind and water. Like their ancestors, the people who put down roots on these changing lands continue to adapt. We've got a nice aerial view of the coastline. The caption says, Hatteras Inlet, seen from the ferry terminal at the northern end of Ocracoke Island, opened when a hurricane blew through in 1846, and it continues to change almost daily. So we can see the outer banks in the distance curving up and making a sharp curve to the right, with a little bubble of land at the end, a lot of its greenery, and that's where it seems to end. And then we have down here the terminal at the end of a long road, which is up seen up rather close to the camera here, even though it's an aerial view. And there's some scrub bushes and lots of sand, and you can see how the water has lots of sandbanks or in it. Or some have come to the top of the surface, but others, you can tell by the discoloration of the water color, are just below the surface. So it's pretty treacherous waters for a boater. And that's why they call it shifting sands. Along the thread of sand that seems to dangle suspended between an expanse of Carolina blue sky and the vast indigo of the Atlantic, there is certainty in the uncertain. On North Carolina's barrier islands, what is here today can be gone tomorrow. A strong northeast blow can render the tangible ethereal. This sliver of land, whose resiliency is often mistaken for fragility, is unyielding and inflexible in its will to transform. It bows only to the mighty Atlantic Ocean. Her force of energy shapes the seaward dunes, molds the soundside marshes, and shoves and tugs all that stands between. This dynamic system is a not-so-gentle reminder of the endurance of impermanence. Today, a little more land may belong to the sea, tomorrow a little less. Always the edge of the sea remains an elusive and indefinable boundary. Rachel Carson writes in The Edge of the Sea. Off the coast of North Carolina's mainland, the only constant is change. Links in a chain. Bound by the Atlantic to the east and our estuarine system to the west, North Carolina's barrier islands are giant deposits of sand transported by waves that bring sediment from the intercontinental shelf. This system, one of the most dynamic on Earth, hems in our sounds and creates harbored bodies of water that form marshes and provide critical marine habitats. They guard the mainland, defending it against the brutal force of the Atlantic Ocean during extreme weather events. Our barrier island system belongs to the ocean, says Stan Riggs, a marine geologist who's been studying our coastline for more than 50 years. Riggs, now in his 80s, is a fast walker with a quick tongue that rattles off rates of erosion and accretion that span decades. He's the type of scholar who looks as comfortable trekking across a beach or wading through a marsh as standing in a classroom. Wherever the ocean comes into contact with land, he continues, if there's sand and low topography, there will always be barrier islands. They are part of the ocean's anatomy. The nature of their formation is where similarities between islands end. No two barrier islands are the same, Riggs explains. They change in different ways and at different rates. These sloping piles of sand are not static beings. They are living, breathing ecosystems whose evolution is unceasing. As weather patterns change, winds shift, and sea levels rise and fall, barrier islands respond by morphing, transforming, and adapting. Karen Willis Amspacher, an advocate of coastal heritage and director of the Core Sound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center, grew up on Harker's Island, but knew that her family had roots on Shackelford Banks, the barrier island to the southwest. The last residents left Shackelford Banks in the early 1900s. Still, she says, that strip of land was and continues to be part of our lives, an extension of our community and a connection to generations before us. Even as a child, I knew that it was part of my story. I knew it was sacred. She recalls noticing each spring how much hurricanes and winter storms had changed Shackelford Banks during the fall and winter. We knew it was its own environment, with its own capacity to ebb and flow, just like the tide, she says. A bad storm would come through, and it would cut a little inlet through the banks. But then, when the wind shifted, it would all fill back in. It was constantly changing, and it still is. The march westward. Despite the uncertainty of an island's movement, the behavior of barrier islands has predictable characteristics. They evolve according to the laws of nature and depend on four factors: wave energy, availability of sand, the shape of the beach, and changes in sea level. If one factor changes, the others adjust to maintain balance. For instance, when wave energy and sea level increase during a storm or hurricane, the oceanfront beach flattens to dispel energy across a broader surface. This dynamic equilibrium undergirds the system's enduring will to persist. As an encroaching sea threatens to inundate and drown those low-lying bars of sand, our islands fight to maintain their meager elevation and deliberately march westward, creeping across the sound toward a recessing mainland shoreline. They've been migrating from the continental shelf for the past 10,000 years. Signs of island movement abound, from sand whipping across Highway 12 on the Outer Banks to the opening and closing of inlets. In 1999, Buxton Village on Hatteras Island took center stage as officials at Cape Hatteras National Seashore oversaw the movement of Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. When the structure was completed in 1870, it stood 1,500 feet from the water's edge. By the late 1980s, erosion had taken its toll, and the lighthouse was a mere 120 feet from the ocean. Over 23 days, the tallest lighthouse in the country was moved 2,900 feet from where it had stood for more than 125 years. Today, waves sometimes break across the original location. A different fate has often befallen structures that were not relocated. Dwight Burris, a seventh-generation Hatteras Islander, now retired from Coast Guard Search and Rescue, recalls that when he was a boy, the old Hatteras Inlet Coast Guard station stood on the north end of Ocracoke. It was abandoned in the 1950s because of erosion. "We watched the sea encroach on the station and take parts of the docks," he says. "Then the boathouse, then the main building. When the foundation collapsed, you could see the tower for a while in the water, and then, pretty soon, nothing. Now there are just pilings." Island movement makes itself known through both disappearance and revelation. The black oyster shells and large orange-colored clams, now scattered across oceanside beaches, may have originally inhabited the sounds. Riggs explains that as islands migrate landward, they expose shells that lived in the sounds several hundred or thousands of years ago. In Corolla, waves often wash past groves of beachside stumps, remnants of an old-growth forest. "It is a battleground," Riggs says. "The ocean does not care about the land. It does what it's going to do. It tears it up. It erodes it. It rebuilds it." The march forward. The fickle spirit of the sea defines the geography of the barrier islands and shapes those who call them home. Those living at the water's edge bear witness to the Atlantic's seemingly unfounded savagery and bask in her gentle and generous nature, too. Like the islands themselves, people, too, have always adapted. From indigenous islanders to colonial settlers to whalers at the turn of the 20th century, people have learned to live with hurricanes, winter storms, and the general unpredictability of life on barrier islands. Battered by the storms of 1896 and 1899, residents of Diamond City, on the storm-wrecked Shackelford Banks, floated their homes across the sound to safer places like Harker's Island, Salter Path on Bogue Banks, and Promise Land in Moorhead City. They didn't expect things to last, says Amspacher, whose ancestors once lived in Diamond City. There was no permanence in their lives. They lived with the elements. They had no choice. Over the past half century, our relationship with our barrier islands has shifted. A network of infrastructure and advanced engineering has provided never-before-known access, encouraging a new tourist-based economy and brisk development. Today, buyers often seek oceanfront views, and we attempt to quell Mother Nature. We build higher dunes, install jetties, harden our shorelines, and pump millions of cubic yards of sand onto our beaches. Our barrier islands have always changed, but the way we reconcile that has also changed, Amspacher says. My grandparents were accepting of their environment. It never crossed their mind that there was enough engineering or enough money or enough magic to stop the ocean. I'm not sure if there is today. Nothing is guaranteed. To walk the shoreline along one of North Carolina's barrier islands is to step out of the ordinary. These islands are where we seek refuge from the mundane and respite from the chaos. They renew our spirit and remind us of nature's sophistication. They are the amphitheater to the stars and an observation platform to the depths of the ocean. The stitch of sand running along our coastline is as curious and enchanting a place as anywhere in the world. Its beauty and geography defy definition, and its boundaries hold fast to mutability. Perhaps in the island's elusive nature lies their allure. Well, we just have 1 minute left, so let's see what the advertiser who supports this magazine would like you to know about. Come see Wilson! Spend the day with us and explore many art galleries, museums, shops, theaters, lakes and trails, delicious food, our brew scene, and the whirligigs. Make your visit to Wilson a unique experience. ComeSeeWilson.com is the address, or you can call 800-497-7398. And Pinnock Village would like you to live well. Serenity of the Sand Hills lies a vibrant neighborhood of friendly, engaging people who embrace active, lifelong living. You can schedule your tour today by calling 910-692-0300. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I sure hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.